From the Sky News Centre at 5, police have named a teenage girl who's been stabbed outside a school in the West Midlands. Chloe West was attacked in the upper body and face outside Ridgewood High School in Stourbridge this morning. An 18-year-old man's been arrested. Superintendent Stuart Johnson has updated reporters on Chloe's condition.
She is a pupil here at Ridgewood High School. She's 14 years old. The latest information that I have is that her injuries are not now believed to be life-threatening, although they are serious.
The parents of a British woman who went missing from a cruise ship are pleading for information about where she is. Rebecca Corrion from Chester was last seen aboard the Disney Wonder off the coast of Mexico 10 days ago. Concerns for the 24-year-old's safety grew after she failed to report for her scheduled shift. Rebecca's mum, Anne, says she hasn't given up hope of seeing her daughter again.
I feel like she's alive. I don't feel like she's gone from us. We just need the help to find her, or to find out what's happened. We don't know.
Patients in Scotland won't have to pay for prescriptions from today, just like in Wales and Northern Ireland. But there's anger from taxpayers and health campaigners in England after charges rose 20p to £7.40. In football, Rangers chairman Alistair Johnson says there's a chance the club could go out of business if they don't sort their finances out. Businessman Craig White is close to completing a takeover at Ibrox, but says there are still concerns over tax bills. Bad weather and high winds have delayed the start of Prince Harry's charity walk in the Arctic for 24 hours. He's with a team of wounded servicemen who aim to reach the North Pole. And gales also caused problems for the Queen today. She had to hang on to her hat when she visited Prince William for a tour of a search and rescue helicopter at his RAF base in Anglesey. William also was able to tell his grandparents about some of the rescues he's been able to carry out. That's the latest.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and on the first day of the new financial year, when the coalition cuts begin to bite, we ask, are we heading back to the mass poverty of the 1930s, where the rich use their money to buy power and wage war on the poor? I'm joined this week by arts presenter on Saturday mornings, Billy Quain, and also by old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers. After the 6 o'clock news, well, the tragic death or murder of musician Smiley Culture, who died in a police raid 10 days ago. We get the latest from his nephew, Merlin Emmanuel. And the referendum on the new AV voting system is coming up in about a month's time. But what is it? And is it better than what we've got? We hear arguments for and against it. And is changing the voting system actually missing the point? When fat cats get so rich, they can afford as many fast cars as they want. What do they crave then? Political power? And how impervious is democracy, political parties and the media to the rich? That's in the second hour, after six. Well, on to our review of this week's news in a minute, but here's first our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, dry but windy. This weekend, highs of 13 Celsius, but wetter on Saturday, but sunnier on Sunday. So, next week, highs 20 Celsius, so it's all slowly creeping up. Warming up and sunnier as the week progresses, wetter and windier at the beginning of the week. Next weekend, that's the 9th and 10th of April, over 20 Celsius up to 21 and sunny and dry next weekend. But watch out for tomorrow, which looks to be the worst of the next couple of weekends. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now. And first of all, we have with us back after a three-week break, it's old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello there.
Now, give us your little quick capsule review of last week's budget.
Well, I thought what was very interesting is that the deficit is actually increasing and that Moody's have said that they're going to possibly downgrade Britain's debt. So all this pain is for no gain, as Ed Miliband pointed out in the House of Commons.
So were you down on this march last Saturday?
I didn't get there because I had other responsibilities, but I think it was very important march. I mean, we've got Billy here who will probably give us the Irish perspective in a minute, but in actual fact, Britain's debt is actually sliding bigger as a result of the cuts.
What about the budget, though? Do you think ameliorate the situation?
Well, I mean, we saw Vince Cable, who used to be a sensible chap, saying, we've got to carry on down this road. It's silliness. The deficit is getting bigger, folks. That hasn't really been pushed in our media, has it? The deficit is getting bigger, not smaller, bigger. I used to teach A-level economics. What I would be saying to my A-level students is, look at this, the deficit gets bigger when you try to cut.
So you're saying that our Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, doesn't actually get A-level economics?
He does, but he's a very wealthy man, as they all are. And of course, it's good for them to carry on cutting, but it's not good for the rest of us.
Also joined by Billy Quain, is BCFM's Saturday Morning Arts programme producer and presenter. Hi, Billy. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening, Tony. How are you today?
Very well. And let's have your perspective on the budget from an Irish point of view, because we've also had quite a lot in the news this week about the Irish, another bailout.
Yes, we have. First of all, we George Osborne gave us a handout probably 6 or 8 weeks ago, which came in somewhere to the tune of £4 or 5 billion, something like that. And of course, he'll see that money back. We're good for it, honest gov. the Irish banks were stress tested yesterday. The findings were published yesterday. Shares of Irish banks were suspended all day yesterday to prevent any massive fluctuations. And it turns out that we need about another €30 billion. Irish Life and Permanent has posted the largest single losses for any Irish corporation ever yesterday at €17.9 billion of what they're now describing as rotten debt. We've gone beyond bad debts and these are rotten debts.
Now, I noticed in The Guardian, I think it was either this morning or yesterday evening, actually it was about midnight last night on The Guardian website, they were saying, well, actually, this is silly because whatever they've done to try and salvage the Irish economy, there's no way these debts are ever going to be repaid. It's going to be defaulted.
There is some elements in Irish society that suggest we should default on this, but the long and short of it is there are an awful lot of Irish people still driving around in €50,000 four-wheel drive Jeeps, filling them up with diesel, going off on 4 or 5 holidays a year. There's money arrived. No, I kid you not. I mean, we're in the West Country. We saw maybe a slightly lesser number of Irish punters, as they refer to, come over 2 weeks ago for the Cheltenham Festival. They were still spending money like it was going out of fashion. Ireland will pay back the debt eventually.
No, they won't.
I think, unfortunately...
We won't pay our debt, and you won't either.
Martin, you have your say in a minute. Let Billy finish.
Unfortunately for us, we've got this well, let's call it a flagellant streak, shall we? That we will drag ourselves over hot coals for the next 40 years to make the annuities on these debts. Enda Kenny has come in with the new coalition government, Fine Gael and Labour, and he has been in some fairly intensive talks with the European Commission and with Olly Wren to try and bring down the interest rate repayment on the gross debt, the €70 billion. Well, it's still subject to negotiation because the contagion that was spoken about 6 or 8 months ago is now beginning to leak out. Portugal's debt has been massively downgraded, upgraded, depending on which way you call it. Portugal is becoming a greater risk, and now there's a fear that they may need a bailout. The flip side to this is a lot of the accession countries, weirdly enough, like Romania and Hungary and Poland even, who had been sticking well within the confines of the ERM guidelines, the plus or minus 2% on their GDP to national debt, they're now starting to be sucked into this spiral because of the fact that Irish investors and British investors indeed had bought so much property over there.
But Billy, if the Irish government debt is actually considered now increasingly risky by these ratings agencies, what makes you so confident that you will pay the debt back? They're not saying that for no reason, are they? They know that there's a risk now that there will be no repayment.
Well, if we go back in into the mists of time and look what George Soros did to John Major's government in 1993, 1991, whenever it was. He tore the country down just by speculating on sterling having to devalue. And an awful lot of the talk about Irish debt at the moment is being perpetrated by the likes of Bill Gross at PIMCO and an awful lot of these other massive, massive hedge fund managers who are saying, do you know what? There's money to be made on putting the word out that Irish debt is going to go rotten. We are now an educationally based economy in Ireland. We have never been a manufacturing economy. And as the euro gradually claws back its strength against the dollar and against sterling, we're going to see more and more people coming back to Ireland and realising that it is a good place to spend money. It's a place, finally, after 15 years of craziness, that you can start to get value for money. Tourism will help. Agriculture will help. Maybe not as much as it used to do. But I think in the fullness of time, we will get the debt repaid. And there will be some semblance of normality returning to Irish house prices.
And Martin, you studied economics at Oxford University. You think what Billy's saying is actually he's living in a bit of an illusion.
Billy is speaking as if he was the Irish finance minister and saying what the Irish finance minister should say. And I have to ask you, did you vote Fine Gael in the election?
No, I've never voted in an Irish election.
All right. Well, it sounds like Fine Gael to me. It's blue shirt stuff. In actual fact, we are not going to pay our debts, and nor are you, and nor is anybody. The whole thing is going down the tubes, mate.
Look, Martin, can you just explain that?
Once you get into a situation where the bond market decides that you can't pay, you can huff and you can puff, but you're not going to pay. And as I said, Moody's rated British debt is AAA at the moment, but Moody's were hinting last week we're going to downgrade it from AAA because actually you can't pay by cutting. You can't. You can't cut your way out of a crisis. And the great British economist, he was a homosexual, Keynes, you can't cut your way out of a crisis. And you're not going to cut your way out of a crisis in Dublin, and we're not going to cut our way out of a crisis in London either. The banks are bust, and there's going to have to be a big reckoning.
So, Martin, are you saying that the banks are a sort of parasite on the system now, that they're kind of killing off the host?
They are. Everybody's lived in a fool's paradise, as Billy will tell us. That's what's been going on. And they're still spending on the credit card, but it's all finished, and there's going to have to be a reckoning. The wealthy classes in the Hill of Howth in Dublin or in North London, wherever it is, they are going to have to pay. They are going to have to pay, and that's what should have happened in your election. And Enda Kenny did say that he was going to renegotiate the debt, and that was the right thing. But he's now said, oh, we can't renegotiate it. Well, you can't renegotiate it, you can't pay it.
The negotiations are ongoing, and to be fair to the Irish voter, they weren't given many viable options in that election.
Indeed.
And I blame Enda Kenny for a lot of what happened in Ireland in the last 10 years because he wasn't a sufficiently strong Ed Miliband is currently guilty of this.
One of the
most important roles in any democracy is the leader of the opposition. And Enda Kenny was so limp-wristed and weak-willed for 10 years and not holding Fianna Fáil to account. And Ed Miliband is starting to fall into the same little trap of rhetoric and sniping now, that it's exceptionally important to hold the government to account in their own house.
Now, you may be wondering why we're talking about Ireland, where actually we live in Britain. Martin, can you just give us an idea? Is it actually important to be looking at Ireland? Because it does seem to me that it could be going through what we are going to be going through later.
Indeed, they are going through what we're going to go through in 6 months' time. But of course, as Ireland crashes, the city of London is exposed to £200 billion of Irish debt. That's just Irish debt. Mm. Not Portuguese debt, Peruvian debt, South African debt. That's all to come. The City of London, in fact, is owed money by everybody, and none of them are going to pay. So the British economy is definitely stuffed. The Irish economy is completely stuffed. We're moving into a non-capitalist discussion. And you'll find that you saw that Sinn Féin got 14 people elected in the Republic.
That was a protest vote.
It was a protest vote.
That's exactly the same
vote. That was a protest vote.
That's exactly the same vote that got the Lib Dems into a coalition.
Well, we're coming to talk about AV later. I actually think having coalitions and proper discussions, your politics are more flexible than ours. We've now got a rubbish government, which we can't get rid of for 4 years. There's going to be a nuclear war and an economic meltdown before we next have an election in this country. You'll have an election quicker than we will.
Well, there may be an election quicker than you think, Martin. But anyway, £100 million worth of arts cuts, a quarter of our museums, galleries and theatres in Britain today lose their funding. So here's a representative of the Actors Union, Equity. His name's Sam West, and he was speaking to the 500,000 marchers in Hyde Park last Saturday.
I do not want art for a few any more than I want education for a few or freedom for a few. William Morris said that. Early trade unionists were quite clear about how a 24-hour day should be divided. 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours for our own improvement. We're not just here to work our asses off for 50 years and die. We believe, don't we, that art is for everyone. That just as you shouldn't be denied good health care because you've got less money, you shouldn't be able to experience better art because you're rich. Ballet is not just for the middle classes. Ballet is for miners' children too. In fact, isn't there a film about that? And a show running in London and on Broadway and in 8 other countries across the world, making millions for the Treasury. Let no one tell us we can't afford it. The entire Arts Council budget of this country before cuts is £450 million. That's about 17p per person per week. That's half what we spend subsidising the arms trade. It's 5% of the money lost to corporate tax evasion every year. A Robin Hood tax on the banks would raise that money in 8 days. Theatres are not wasteful places. My union, Equity, is fighting for an actor's minimum wage of £400 a week. It wasn't people on those sort of wages who produced this deficit. These cuts are ideological. Conservatives don't like art being cheap because it educates and enlightens working people. The history of the trade union movement is stuffed with stories of people who educated themselves, who, like William Morris, but refused to believe that learning was something for the few, through night school, local libraries, universities that didn't cost them £9,000 a year. With structures like that in place, a society can truly call itself big. The coalition's right hand doesn't know what its left hand is doing. On Monday, Michael Gove said that children should be reading 50 books a year. Good idea. So why not stop local authorities closing 520 libraries? Has Michael Gove worked out how much 50 books a year cost? Is he only governing the country for the people who can buy them, not borrow them? That's not just a failure of government, it's a failure of imagination. Perhaps he should go to the theatre more often. This hands-off approach to local authority funding means councils are given budgets that are impossible to balance, and the government says, sorry, it's none of our business. In Somerset, an arts budget of £159,000, 0.0004 of their total grant, has been cut by 100%. Not only does that affect the provision of exhibitions, classes, theatre trips and touring on a scale down to the tiniest village in a largely rural county, it also sends a message to people who live in Somerset. The arts are not for you, it says. Don't think you have anything to say, or if you want to say it, go somewhere else. But the arts are a flourishing pyramid. Cut funding to the smaller regional organisations, and sooner or later you starve the larger ones to death. Britain becomes a cultural desert. This government has proved again and again that it knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. Sometimes the bottom line isn't the bottom line. Some things in life are worth it anyway. When we've been sacked or chucked, or even if we're just going into a gallery to escape the rain, art reminds us that our own unfortunate circumstances are not all we have, that we really are all in this together. Art is essential for dealing with the tricky condition we call human. Access to it is not a luxury, it's a right worth fighting for. Thank you.
Well, that was Sam West there from Actors Union Equity speaking in Hyde Park last Saturday, as not heard on the news. Sam is the son of Fawlty Towers actress Prunella Scales and craggy old actor Timothy West. Now, maybe to you first, Martin. This whole idea of ideological cuts, what is all this? I keep hearing that the cuts are ideological.
Well, they are, because in actual fact, as you cut, the deficit is getting bigger. This is the thing that people... The unfairness...
What are the ideas behind these cuts?
Well, the idea is it's a simplistic idea. When we used to take kids in at A level, we'd say, to teach them economics, they come with it, well, you can't spend what you haven't got. Everybody knows how to manage a family budget, and therefore they think that we've got to cut back because we can't afford... Whatever it came from, it's the bankers that have lost the money, but we've got to balance the books somehow. Now, the first thing you teach them, age 16, if they want to go to university, is that's all rubbish, because in actual fact, any society can produce anything it wants to produce. The money system is actually a tool, not a master. And that's the first thing you learn. And we've had conservative politicians sitting in this chair here saying exactly this stuff. And their kids, I can't remember the chap, he said his kids are doing business studies. Business studies. Now, the top universities will not take A-level business studies because they don't regard it as a serious A-level. Economics is a serious A-level. And if you're an economics student, you've got to understand all this stuff about we've got to balance the books, that's all wrong. Now, it's not what normal people think. Normal people think you've got to balance the books, but that's not economics.
Well, what Sam is saying is that it's actually one of the ideas here is that actually it's a bad idea for people to be educated, because that means that they can understand the circumstances and decide to get involved in the political system. That sounds a bit far-fetched.
That's a bigger question. That's a sociology question. But the fact is, you see, during the 1930s, the Works Progress Administration in the United States didn't just build dams and railways. They also put on theatre groups. Yeah, they employed actors to go out and explain to the people what the government was doing. There's work for everybody if we want it.
Billy, you know, obviously you're doing an arts show here on BCFM every Saturday morning, and what we're hearing is just in Somerset, as Sam said there, £160,000 going from the arts budget just like that, and that's the entire arts budget of Somerset.
Frankly, it's scandalous. However, it's important to leaven this argument. There's a nice round headline figure of £100 million cut, and everybody's focusing on that quite keenly. A lot of what the Arts Council does is admirable. A lot of what they're not doing, we can do without.
But frankly, what about the fact that we've got a quarter of the museums, galleries and theatres will actually lose all their funding? What? That's right across the country. A quarter will have no funding as of now.
I was going to come to the point. What galls me about arts application, arts funding, arts council funding applications, God almighty, sorry. What galls me about that is that there are individuals, probably three or four in each one of these organisations of the 1,500 who have applied, who have probably spent a fortnight preparing to put this application in. Now, I'm not a great one for productivity testing or man hours or even the time and motion man, but there has been an awful lot of time and money spent just applying for this windfall of money from the Arts Council. The 100 million cut has been leavened to the tune of 80 million by the National Lottery stepping in. So there's a £20 million gross deficit that's been handed down here. A few, locally speaking, a few have done not so well out of it. Norwest Media Centre has retained their funding. The Bristol Old Vic has retained its funding, but it's frozen. The Tobacco Factory has been given a hansel of £60,000, which actually, if you look at the number of shows coming through the Tobacco Factory every year and the amount of outreach work that they do there, not just within the Southville community, but all across the city, and with developing new acting and writing talent down there, it doesn't, £60,000 won't go far. The big headline that didn't get funding from a Bristol standpoint yesterday was on Wednesday was St George's. But it turns out St George's hadn't been funded by the Arts Council anyway. They had applied for some Arts Council money, as did Show of Strength Theatre Company, based on in Bedminster also. Sheila Hannan, the director of Show of Strength, is going to be joining me at 10:30 tomorrow morning, and we will trash this out in slightly greater detail. What has happened is that a lot of companies who were reliant on funding for some of their work with older people, or work with people with learning difficulties, or work with children, or work with underprivileged inner city communities, or the homeless, or whoever it happens to be, that has gone away. It's very easy to point the finger and blame George Osborne for this, or to blame anybody else. What we actually need to be focusing on is getting ourselves out of the house on a Tuesday evening and going to see something. It's all well and good to pay your £160 a year, whatever it is, for a TV licence and say, right, I've paid for my Coronation Street for the year, or I've paid for my embarrassing bodies, or whatever it happens to be. With the advent of greater and greater technology, you don't have to miss your favourite telly to go step outside your front door, eat out in one of the fantastic restaurants that we've got, which is providing employment for 10 people in Bristol, go to the theatre, which is providing employment for 30 people in Bristol, and maybe, here's a mad idea, don't go to the movies, which is all tied up with Time Warner and AOL, who are, you know, corporate tax dodging in the States. And none of that money, I certainly View Cinemas or any of these larger conglomerates, they're paying dividends to their shareholders somewhere off in their ivory towers, as Martin would say. And none of that is going back into the local community.
I mean, we're talking, if you want to go out for a meal and go out to the theatre, you're talking about £100 for a couple of people, quite potentially.
Well, what kind of theatre are you going to see, Tony?
Well, I mean, and a meal too. You know, then you are talking about quite a lot of money. There's for many people out there, actually, they don't have that extra even £10 or £20 in the week to spend on something like that. It's going towards essential things like travel, the kids, all that kind of stuff.
I mean, it doesn't have to be every week. And also, I mean, a number of the theatres are doing Taste and Try, or they're doing family tickets or anything like that. And actually, it's, I think, one of the great poxes on late 20th century society is the fact that people are starting to use the television set to babysit their children. And children are digesting almost exclusively all of their media through a screen. It's no longer about picking up a book and a tactile experience, and it's no longer about the immediacy and the three-dimensional experience of going to see a storyteller or going to see a puppet show or going to see something in the theatre. And I would love to see more people just getting out to see stuff. It doesn't have to cost the earth, and people are crying out for an audience to come in and see their work.
Now, Martin, Sam West was invoking the spirit of William Morris there. Do you think he's sort of that's ancient history? It's irrelevant now?
Of course not. I mean, you know your history, know your destiny, and the abundance of water the fool is thirsty, as Bob Marley said. I'm afraid we've got to get some basic economics dinned into the heads of the population. You can't cut your way out of a crisis. And come the summer, the British are going to fail to pay their debts, and the Irish are definitely going to fail to pay their debts. So all this flim-flam will then confront the fact that we have got to deal with the situation properly, and we will need art to lead from the front.
Right, well, on Wednesday this week, Prime Minister's questions descended into abuse, more reminiscent of the Paris Commune in the French Revolution than a civilised democracy. And the personal attack came from none other than the Prime Minister, David Cameron, himself, while replying to a question from Labour MP from up north somewhere, I'm not quite sure where, Joan Whalley.
Will the Prime Minister understand the need for job creation in Stoke-on-Trent and arrange for his colleagues at local governments and at BIS to liaise with us and with the Treasury to make sure that we get that investment when the new list is announced in July?
Very good.
Now, I completely understand the point the Honourable Lady makes, but particularly in Stoke, where the Potteries community... I wish the Shadow Chancellor would occasionally shut up and listen to the answer.
I don't know whether...
Order! Order!
Other members can now follow the Prime Minister's advice to the Shadow Chancellor. We need a bit of order. The Prime Minister.
I may be alone in finding him the most annoying person in modern politics, but I've got a feeling the Leader of the Opposition will one day agree with me, but there we are. Right, where were we? The Potteries, yes. Look, clearly there are massive issues because of the decline of the Potteries. I completely understand the need for Stoke to have that support. I think it's very important that she's working to bring together the pottery communities, including other MPs, including the local enterprise partnership. And yes, I'll certainly ask my right-hand friend, the Chancellor, to look at whether it can be in the next lot of enterprise zones, because we want to help the pottery communities that she represents. Yeah.
That was former PR consultant, now our Prime Minister, Conservative Prime Minister, David Cameron, there speaking at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. Billy, let's start with you. Do you think this is the way that the PMQs, the Prime Minister's Questions, should be conducted? Is it just a little bit of fun and a bit of witty banter? Or is that the kind of thing, you know, personal attacks and on people for talking? I mean, because you are actually allowed to talk in the House of Commons chamber.
Well, it's supposed to be a talking shop, isn't it? But frankly, I mean, the blood was up and there was a little bit of wit. And to be honest, both sides have a whole bunch of their cronies behind them, egging them on anyway. And it is, a lot of it is point scoring.
It's difficult to tell on the telly, but it looked like actually most of that noise was coming from the Conservative side as they were egging the Prime Minister on, right?
Yeah, they're probably telling him to do more of it. And actually, I don't think there's anything wrong with feeling sufficiently moved to passion about your beliefs that you will raise your voice to somebody. And occasionally when somebody is speaking tosh, then you tell him he's speaking tosh. And maybe if it's Martin will have some opinions on this, the appointment of Ed Balls to the Shadow Treasury. What's his new job description?
The Shadow Chancellor. I think it's quite interesting because he's actually trying to push he's thought of as a bit of a Blairite, a bit close to Brown, but he's actually trying to push the policy to the left.
Yeah, but he's been branded as a bit of a bulldog, and
he's a bit of a bulldog, and his wife Yvette Cooper is also, you know, when Alan Johnson was appointed as Shadow Chancellor, we had Kerry McCarthy in here, mm-hmm. and she was surprised, and I was surprised because he expected either Yvette or Ed Balls. Mm-hmm. I didn't vote for Ed Balls to be the leader of the Labour Party. I did not. But I think he's a very, very intelligent guy, and he's saying the kind of things I'm saying, which is we've got to change the game here. We've got to change the discussion. Coming back to PMQs, I was involved in the Polish Parliament years ago, and it's a very boring thing. People go up to the lectern and they speak, and it's all put on the record. All this Yarboo sucks stuff, which we take for granted. Mm-hmm. You bring foreigners in there to look at it and say, this is just a madhouse.
Yeah. I think it's important to have a fully fleshed out debate.
But that's not a fully fleshed out debate. that's Punch and Judy.
You're the most annoying man in politics. Yeah. It's not really.
Yeah, I don't know. You could argue serious. That. I mean, at least you know where you stand with him at that point.
No, but it's not serious stuff. I mean, when I saw the Polish Parliament at work, it was very boring. Mm-hmm. Very boring. A guy goes up to the lectern, or a woman goes up to the lectern, they have 10 minutes, a green light goes on when you're at 9 minutes, and then a red light goes on at 10 minutes, and that's your go. It's very boring, very, very, you know, you watch it, it's just like watching paint dry, but it's business-like.
I hate to say, I mean, I think you're taking this as an example of something that maybe is flying quite close to the wind in British terms, but frankly, if you go to the Italian Parliament, this sort of stuff happens every
Libyan Parliament.
Day.
Woo!
Okay,
Saudi Parliament.
Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima, nuclear disasters I have known. Our local campaigners are redoubling efforts to stop two gigantic new nuclear plants being built at Albury Northwest and Hinckley Southwest, both upwind of Bristol. Dr. Chris Busby is a UK Green Party nuclear expert and author who's been very critical of censorship and distortion in the British media about nuclear energy and has hardly appeared on UK TV, certainly on the news anyway. This excerpt is from English language Russian channel Russia Today, and it's Dr. Chris Busby.
The problem is that under those very high radiation fields, robots don't work, and they certainly found that at Chernobyl. At Chernobyl, they paid huge amount of money to the Germans to provide robots to go in there and remove the pieces of fuel, and the robots just packed up. They didn't work, because under those radiation fields, the electronics don't work. So you have to use people. Unfortunately, I don't think that even with the people there's much that they can do. The thing is out of control, and we have a sort of science fiction scenario now. We're not being told everything, and right from the beginning we weren't being told everything, and this is one thing that happened with Chernobyl as well. That is another parallel between these two situations, is that we don't get told anything, and the truth slowly comes out as if it's being dragged out of people. In my opinion, it's going to finish the north of Japan off. I don't see what they can do about it. They're going to have a very large exclusion zone. The cost is going to be absolutely phenomenal. So the nuclear industry, I think, is finished. But then I thought that after Chernobyl, to be honest. And what happened there was that there was a massive cover-up, an international cover-up by the nuclear lobby of all the health effects of the Chernobyl accident, which is only just coming out now. We now know, as a result of research, that at least 1 million people have died as a result of the Chernobyl accident. Yet we still have the nuclear industry telling us that only a few liquidators died and there really wasn't any problem except thyroid cancer in a few children. And that can be cured. That was a pack of lies, and I think we're going to get another pack of lies after this, so people should watch out.
That's Dr. Chris Busby, who's an expert in leukemia, particularly childhood leukemia, clusters around these various nuclear plants and also around fallout from previous accidents. Billy, do you want to start on this? What are your thoughts about what's been going on at Fukushima? Because it does seem like it's going to be known, and certainly in the future, as one of the biggest of all time of these nuclear accidents.
It seems, from an outsider's standpoint, that we're being drip-fed some truths, some half-truths, and some lies. The thing is, it's a constantly evolving situation. It hasn't been a nice, clear crash-bang wallop like Chernobyl was when the whole thing went up in a matter of minutes.
But it's really worrying, isn't it? What he was saying there is that even the robots, that they could, because people are getting, anyone that gets close to these melted-down reactors and these fusion piles of radioactivity, they've got getting massive doses of radiation, so they can't send people in. They try and send the robots in, and they find that the robots are also just basically stopping working because of the incredibly intense radioactive fields.
Yes, and this is part of the ever-present danger with nuclear fuel. And I couldn't believe what I heard from E.ON the other day when they said, yes, we're pressing ahead with Hinkley C, and we submitting plans for it and everything else. Frankly, I mean, the reason that nuclear power stations are by the sea or by a water source is to keep things cool in the first place. The downside to that is once they start to leak, then radiation travels very easily through the water. And of course, with the Japanese diet consistent mainly of seafood and aquaculture-based items, then of course it's going to have a massive knock-on effect for the entire population.
Well,
one of the things that
Chris is saying, was saying in that report, we didn't have that quite there, was that it could be in the future that something like a third or even a half of Japan may become like the Chernobyl zone.
Yes, like
people
a nuclear
just simply cannot go there.
And this was, I hate to say it, but you know, the Pulp Fiction of the 1950s was full of this sort of stuff, and it seems to be strange but true that these things are coming to fruition.
Martin, what about the economics of it, though? Because we are facing these two potential big new reactors near here in Bristol.
I think this will knock... I mean, the economics have always been a nonsense. I wrote a paper about this in the 1980s when they tried to privatise the British nuclear industry. I wrote a paper about this for East European market, as it were. And, of course, once the private sector looked at the risks, if they've got to pay compensation to all these people in northern Japan, it's only the state that would ever produce a nuclear power economy. The private market would never touch it without subsidy. So it's all quite straightforward. We don't have to have this. It doesn't actually make any money. The only reason we've got nuclear power is because nuclear weapons. We had nuclear weapons and there was a side. Can't we do something with this nuclear stuff we've got? We'll have nuclear power as well. But the economics of it are all wrong, completely ridiculous. And this is making absolutely clear. If the private sector was running these things in Japan, it is the private sector, of course, but of course the state will pick up the bill. There's no way that this is realistic. And I interestingly, of course, in Ireland in the 70s, the Cairn saw they were going to put a nuclear power station there, mm-hmm. and people said no. But of course, at the same time, Chernobyl has still destroyed the sheep industry in the north of England.
And it always will. They're picking up radiation most recently in Glasgow and Oxfordshire, and there has been some trace radiation found in Ireland as well, of course. But the interesting aspect to all of this that only occurred to me the other day, and there was somebody from Greenpeace who was doing a talking head on the BBC News about it, was saying that if the green energy industries had been subsidised to the same level as the nuclear industry has been in Britain in the last 10 years, then Britain would be 90% 90% serviced by green energy, renewable energy sources, wind and wave.
Well, it's also about saving energy. That's the real key. We don't actually have to use as much energy as we use. We've got to re-engineer everything to be absolutely efficient. That's the way to go forward. And then any kind of energy production is bound to be a bit problematic. So you've got to just reduce it. Triple glazing.
Now, if you're of a sensitive disposition or don't like swearing, you better switch off your radio right now or turn over for 5 minutes, because this next item contains some bad language in the name of politics and rap music.
Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, not for sale. So the budget of the PCTs, he wants to hand to the GPs, oh please. Don't geeks are gonna buy from any willing provider and get care from private companies. So the pie and the one apiece, got the rice on the peas like mice for the cheese. Told truth when I ride the beat, you talk shy when you speak. See money when you close your eyes to sleep. So fall back, your face looks like a shriveled up bull sack. The stuff that you say is bullcrap. I'm sure Andy Pandy snorts crack. Health minister, I mean sinister. You know the public will finish ya. Is your brain really that miniature? You're full of crap, give yourself an enema. You're filthy rich from those who represent Walker's Chris. Mars and pizza hot proved you're a health slut. And you're always talking shit. £134 an hour, every week that's quite a lot of quids. And you came to the conclusion the food industry should be a little less strict. Scandal disclosed that you flipped your second home. You said your claims were within the rules. Filled your pockets, took us for jokes. How would you cope when broke folk get ill, injured and broke, but they don't have the dough to get their life back on the road, so the poor die slow and the rich take control. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, not for sale. Lansley's white paper liberating the NHS sets out a plan where we'll become more like the US, and care will be farmed out to private companies who will sell their service to the NHS via GPs, who will have more to do with their service purchase arrangements than anything to do with even seeing their patients. He's been given cash by Johnny Nash, chairman of Care UK, a private healthcare provider who, if they have their own way, will be the biggest beneficiaries of Conservative Lib Dem policies to privatise healthcare, pull apart their welfare state. These plans have been slacked by patient organisations, charities, unions, nursing and medical institutions. The Royal College of GPs even joined the attack, looked closely at the proposals and said they were crap. So say yes for the NHS, Andrew Lansley, cause soccer David Cameron's breast is questing for the rich to pay less, and the poor have to stress, it'll be one big mess. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, not for sale.
Well, I don't like swearing, but I think you'd agree that was fairly mild compared to what husband of private healthcare industry lobbyist Sally Lowe and Health Secretary Andrew Lansley intends to do to the National Health Service. And by the way, we're not allowed to know how much his wife gets from the private health insurance industry as part of her lobbying company. Martin, that's you start on this. We have a situation here where the Health Secretary's wife, who actually has a different surname, Sally Lowe, is actually a senior running her own company which does private healthcare lobbying. It's really a bit naughty, isn't it, for him to be involved in the privatisation of the health service?
Well, I mean, it's astonishing because none of this was discussed in the election campaign last May. None of it. It's all just been wheeled out from behind the arras, and we've now got to deal with this. But of course, there's no mandate for any of this. The NHS is not the best in the world, but by God, it's the cheapest.
And Billy, from your perspective from Ireland, you don't actually have something exactly the same as the National Health Service, but what did you think of MC Next Gen's
You do in the North.
Andrew Lansley rap there?
Well,
I think NextGen's got a great future. But going back to what we were saying about Arts Council earlier on, I suspect NextGen has become the artist he is because of some potentially Arts Council funded outreach program much earlier in his career. So
Version on the rates.
Well, to be honest with you, he summed up very succinctly and with some elegance exactly what's facing us and the black hole that we're looking at in terms of whether or not your health, when a bus hits you, should be at the beck or the decision of somebody who's going to be paying dividends to a shareholder.
But the question here is really, actually, nothing to do with that, surely. It's all about, is this a decision which is being made for the good of the country, or is his wife elbowing him, saying, come on, Andrew, let's privatise National Health Service, because this is what all my paymasters are telling me.
At the risk of sounding unpopular, I think, on the whole, and I'm not pointing a finger at anybody, the civil service or the public sector tends to be overstaffed by a lot of people who sit in meetings, and they eat a lot of biscuits and move paper from one desk to the next. The NHS may be guilty of some of that. However, any time there's NHS cuts proposed because of the fact that the consultants have the management in their pockets, it's always frontline staff that are directly affected. It's always the nurses, it's always the porters, and ultimately it's always the care of the patients. Using the US model as a template is never, ever a good idea. I can't remember the name of the movie, but Michael Moore, my favourite polemicist, did a very interesting documentary not long ago when he took injured US servicemen to Cuba to be treated for free, professionally, and fixed for free. And they were delighted to do it. They did it in English, even though it's not their native tongue. And I would like to see the last little bit of the free NHS, which was instituted, I think, in 1946, Martin.
Yes.
It is one of the things that defines Britain as a nation. You can get sick and you won't be expected for more than £7.40 to dip into your own pocket to make yourself better.
Well, what about this point, though, Martin, about the private health insurance industry paying large amounts of money, we're not allowed to know exactly how much, to the health secretary's wife, Sally Lowe?
Well, I mean, it's outrageous, isn't it? This was not discussed in the election at all. In fact, Cameron said in the election, we will not mess with the NHS. It's safe in our hands.
Yes, in fact, we've got a leaflet. In fact, I was got a leaflet from his constituency, which says that on the leaflet. So it's a little bit naughty.
Can I just pick up this stuff about the public sector eating biscuits or whatever? As an economist, I find it very strange that a lap dancing club is a profit-making exercise and therefore good, and a hospital or a primary school is bad. You know, look at the waste in our society in the private sector. All this silly stuff that goes on in the private sector, which of course is, because it makes a profit, is absolutely okay.
Billy?
There are certain things that work well in the private sector. Now, Martin, even you would have to admit, if you're prepared to pay £9,000 a term to send your child to Clifton College, they will get a better education. And slice it whichever way you want, that is private sector education.
As we were hearing from the NUT chat the other week, though, on here, actually a lot of it is to do with just the atmosphere created in the classroom by kids that actually want to learn, and it's the motivation that they get from better off parents and well educated parents that makes for a better place.
Yes, I agree. And actually, when you're financially investing in, I mean, I review a lot of shows. This is maybe not the best example. I go and see a lot of shows around town. I am more engaged with the experience of critiquing that when money has come out of my pocket to sit in that seat. It's exactly the same with education. It shouldn't be the same with healthcare. Healthcare.
But what when you don't have any money in your pocket to pay?
Education and healthcare should be provided. If you're ill, you should be looked after. You should be educated the limit of your ability, whatever that ability is. And that's people in Sweden and Finland know exactly what this is about. And we've been dragging our heels for a generation.
Well, could you see yourself paying the income tax levels that they pay in Scandinavia?
I'm on benefits, so I don't care much about this. And there's going to be a big fight about this. When half the population of Ireland are on the dole, they're not going to care about Enda Kenny.
Well, they're pretty close already.
In Norway, you can click and you can see what everybody earns. Everybody is allowed to see what everybody else earns. And of course, people really don't understand that the very wealthy are really much more seriously wealthy than you. And of course, in Norway, I could say, Billy, I'm going to look at how much you earn. Click. I go, click. And you know, people pay their taxes because everybody knows what everybody pays.
So
we've got a situation now where
private sector stuff is coming into the public sector and we're not allowed to know what goes on because it's commercially confidential. Outrageous.
Commercially confidential, I really don't buy that argument much at all.
That's what they're doing.
If you would like to start talking about corporate tax dodgers, then we could bring Philip Green into the argument to say why doesn't he stump up the 100 million that the Irish Council had to foot out of his own corporate tax, or even Vodafone apparently, who are notorious for it. But it's the British arms industry who are subsidised twice as much as the Irish.
But Ireland, of course, became a tax dodge. You know, it was almost like the Cayman Islands at one stage.
Oh, we celebrated it. Yeah, and that's why we were holding out for as long as we were on this idea of accepting a European bailout, because exactly as I predicted a month ago would happen, the European Union are now wanting to start imposing their own corporation tax legislation on Ireland as a sovereign nation.
Indeed.
Okay, onto another news story now. Troops are ready to take over our strike-hit jails. The army's on standby yesterday as prison officers reacted with fury at the planned sell-off of several prisons. Do you have any problems with this, Billy, the idea of private companies taking over our prisons and making money from incarceration?
Well, yes, obviously, because the idea of capitalism, the idea of making a profit, is that you garner in more in sales than you spend in costs. At the moment, the prisons, I imagine, are operating on a pretty tight budget anyway. They're constantly at bursting point in terms of occupancy. Training is quite often an issue. If we cast our minds back to the open prison riots on New Year's Eve down in West Sussex, apparently there was only two trained officers on duty that night when all of the drinking and the arson attack occurred. It's a very bad idea, because the first thing the private sector is going to try and do is to optimise profitability. And I can talk about this with some authority, because I used to work for a brewery who were very good at peddling students cheap drinks so that we could optimise our profitability and, dare I say it, our productivity of the staff. You don't want prison officers who are responsible for the safety and well-being of possibly innocent individuals to be clock watching or under pressure to have their productivity optimised.
Martin, if Group 4 or G4S, as they're now called, take over a prison, they can run it cheaper. Why not?
They run it cheaper in the way that Billy's describing. They scrimp and they save and they don't do it properly. Frankly, taking away somebody's liberty is a very, very important thing. And it shouldn't. I mentioned the fact that we were having private prisons in Britain to some Danish people that I met on a demonstration a few years ago, and they were horrified. They were horrified. It's completely wrong. I mean, during the Iran-Contra affair, what was going on was that the people in the CIA were bringing drugs into the country and making a big profit on that. And what they were investing in was private prisons to lock the people up who were using the drugs. This is how you can't work on that basis. There is a case for the public sector, and it's not been made properly for a generation, and it's got to be made now. The public sector is not just a useless pile of rubbish. It's a very, very important part of a civilised society.
Five MPs have registered their concern about the census contractor. This is five MPs who've signed a motion raising concerns that the data collected in the census could end up in the hands of the US intelligence chiefs and military companies. They have tabled a parliamentary motion raising the alarm over the decision to involve America's largest arms manufacturer, Lockheed Martin, in gathering the information. Lockheed Martin heads a consortium which in 2008 won the $150 million contract to provide data capture and processing support for the census in England. We also hear that there's an army of enforcers, a 100-strong army of census enforcers has been given police powers to gather criminal evidence against householders who fail to complete the national survey. This is in the Guardian, but Tim Ross. For the first time in the 210-year history of the census, a separate unit of dedicated non-compliance officers authorised to conduct interviews under caution will visit homes across the country. In the last census, apparently, there was only a handful of people were actually prosecuted for not completing the census form, and it looks like there'll be quite a lot more this time. Billy, have you done your census form?
I have done my census form.
But are you happy to fill it out and hand your information to Lockheed Martin?
To be honest, my personal information was relatively scant, purely because I was the second person in the household. I wasn't the primary householder. I certainly don't pay the bills in the household. So in that respect, I don't mind too much because it's not that invasive as you get further down. However, for the primary householder, there is quite a lot of fairly detailed personal information involved in it. However, the argument that the primary householder made to me when I was saying, that's an awful lot about yourself you're revealing in that, it is an official document, and in 100 years' time, maybe some distant relative might like to know a little bit about how we were then. I do agree with you about Lockheed Martin garnering our information and maybe storing it up in some giant Raiders of the Lost Ark style warehouse.
Well, they make missiles, these people, don't they? Yeah, basically, that's one of their main things, and fighter jets, bombers, this kind of thing.
Yes, they're a large corporation who apparently have got data specialism. Then again, there was this whole story in the news earlier this week about the scrapping of the major government IT contracts with companies like Oracle, HP and others being removed from the table. To be honest with you, whichever way you go with trying to collect this information in, limiting the enforcement officers to 100, which seems excessive to me, and also granting them full police powers seems a little OTT, is a bit strange. If you pay tax, and I'm not massively keen on voting or any of that sort of stuff, but if you do pay tax, it's important that you stand up and are prepared to be counted as an occupant of British society.
So are you happy if your personal information ends up on a memory stick on a train somewhere?
I'd be...
Left on a train, as a lot of this government data has been?
I would be happy for my information to end up in the hands of Julian Assange if it meant that the rest of the world was being held to account over my behaviour. So yes, frankly, I've not done anything wrong. I've not broken any laws, so I have nothing to fear from my information falling into the wrong hands. I go on the internet every single day. I'm sure that if some nefarious-minded character out there wanted my information, he could glean it pretty easily and rinse me out for everything I'm worth, which at the moment amounts to a £100 bicycle and the clothes I sit before you in. So, frankly, I don't think I'm that good a target to go after. But I do agree
with
you.
What about things like your religious affiliation? Because, I mean, certainly back in the 1930s in Germany, if people were saying I'm Jewish and putting that down on their form, then there may have been implications in the future about that.
Yes, there may well have been, and there may yet be implications in Britain if we go down the French route for the Muslim population here. Again, it's whether or not you're prepared to stand by the courage of your convictions and actually announce yourself as you exist as of last Sunday, and put that down on paper. I actually think a census is quite a refreshing snapshot of where you have reached in your own tenure in life.
Martin, what about you? Have you filled your census form out yet?
I haven't been sent one because I live in a multiple occupancy private flat, and they just haven't got round to
it. If you had, would you have filled it out by now?
I would have done, yes, because I think there is a purpose in having a census. But we've got data protection laws, which mean that if your data has been gathered for the census, it's not to be used for any other purpose whatsoever. I'm very unhappy about Lockheed Martin. Again, private sector people sticking their finger in. What the hell are they doing there? This is supposed to be an absolutely secure relationship between the individual and the government.
But it's not secure.
Problem,
this is a serious problem, I think, because it's not secure. I mean, I looked at something in the Independent about 6 or 7 years ago where the head of MI6 had invited all the heads of corporate business and to a nice little cosy and secret meeting in London where he was saying, look, if there's any information we can sell you, please let us know.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? That you can't have a public sector which has got a private sector bit to it. They're absolutely separate. And I used to work for the council, and we used to talk about social enterprises and so on, and giving assets to local communities. But the legal people came back to us and said, you can't do that. These are public assets. You can't give them.
But don't you think there's another level that maybe this stuff is being peddled on the open market?
Well, I mean, once we blur the distinction between the public and the private sector, there's all sorts of money to be made by leveraging what the government does. And that's what's happening. We've now got welfare capitalism, where corporations suck on the nipple of the government and make money out of that. And that's not building a better widget, is it?
So, Tony, have you filled in your census?
Actually, no, I haven't. No, I've got no intention of filling it in, so I guess these enforcers are going to be coming for me.
Yes, they will.
Now, thanks to this week's guests, that's Billy Quain and Martin Summers, who will be staying with us actually after the news, where we'll be hearing about the tragic death or murder of musician Smiley Culture, who died in a police raid 10 days ago. And we get the latest from his nephew, that's Merlin Emmanuel. The referendum on the new AV voting system, we'll be talking about that. And also, is changing the voting system missing the point? When the fat cats get so rich they can afford loads of fast cars, what do they crave then? Secret political power? Join us after the news.
FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol